I was a soldier, then a veteran, a husband, and a father. And with my VA home loan, I'm a homeowner. No down payment required and no PMI. Build your future with the VA home loan. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to another episode of Whimsical Wavelengths. Before I jump right in, it's time to do a little bit of housekeeping. First off, Happy Christmas, Merry Holidays, and all the mixing and matching of all the different holidays and solstice-ness that is all going on. I've got my Christmas tree already put up in my living room. My own two monsters are counting down the days using my homemade advent calendar that I do every year. I put little boxes and things together with different kind of candy. It's a fun way to be able to count down, and for kids, they get so incredibly excited. It's a festive time of year, a time where we come together. It's also the time of year where we start reflecting on the year that has passed. And here on Whimsical Wavelengths, it's been a pretty damn good year. Into season two, and just keep going. I think I'm putting together something that is really useful, and perhaps filling a niche that this world needs a little bit more of. But to get better, I need you guys. So, hopefully, in this next year, you will put in a New Year's resolution to reach out and, I don't know, give me some feedback? Tell me what works, what doesn't work, and all that other things. Oh, also, the very first episode of the year will actually be an encore edition. I need that extra 2-week period to get everything ready and make sure that I'm not always behind the eight ball, that I'm putting my best foot forward and producing content that at least I want to hear, and hopefully you do as well. So that very first one, I believe it'll be the first Monday in January, there will be an encore edition, and then we'll move in with my past PhD supervisor, Dr. Glenn Williams-Jones, as part of a 2-part episode, although two different guests, just the location of the science generally stays the same. I'm totally looking forward to it, and I hope you guys are as well. So, why am I doing this? Well, yeah, because I'm a little bit behind. Why am I behind? Because of that trip to Saudi Arabia earlier in October. Fantastic trip. So glad I went there. There's certain things, particularly outside of the major city, that were just culturally hard for me to understand. You could always ask me over beers at one time if you ever catch me at a pub. Ask me about it, but I don't think it's really worthwhile going on to in the podcast. Why? It's not science related, and it's for my day job. So, this is a solo episode. I'm setting it up just for myself, because every once in a while, I take a deviation that is more about history, instead of like cutting-edge research with guests and the like. In season one, I did Nikola Tesla, the Mediterranean Sea, and the rise and fall of leaded gasoline. Here in season two, this is the first episode in this kind of vein. To you, the listener, what would be fun for you? Tell me, perhaps I'll find a way to make an episode all about it. And more importantly, give me some more feedback of whether these types of episodes are good for you. They take me significantly more time and effort to produce and do the research, because they're not really within my wheelhouse, but I feel there's still a lot there to be gained to have someone talk about it and do the storytelling. So today, we're going to look at the planets. Why? Because there's lots we can get into, from prehistoric times to today, and the search for, quote-unquote, Planet Nine. It'll be whimsical. It'll be fun. Well, fun, for at least for me, anyway. And it also will chronicle science progress. How we learn new tools and how those tools enter the scene and change how we view the universe around us. I could cut this whole idea to famous quotes like, "If I've seen further, It is by standing on the shoulders of giants, by Sir Isaac Newton. Or if I wanted more historical, there are many famous quotes, but I'll stick with, you have to know the past to understand the present, which is attributed to Carl Sagan. This idea on analysis is absolutely required right now. We have to know the past to understand the present. So much is being covered up or forgotten or perhaps just turned a blind eye to. And the scary bit of maybe sounding political, vaccination is something that instantaneously comes to mind for me. The hard lessons of the past are being completely ignored. There is no clear data set suggesting that the current vaccine schedule in, say, Canada, and I could choose a different country, is causing more harms than the risks of getting the pathogens if not vaccinated. Yeah, scientific speak, but it should end the discussion for population scale ideas. But I digress. That deviation is to show understanding the past scientific endeavors is useful for providing context to the present and ultimately the future. So, the planets. Because no matter the discipline, the process is similar. To start. How about which planets have we known about since, like, the antiquity? Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. For each of these planets, the earliest records are from the Babylonian astronomers of about 1000 BCE. Or, you know, 3000-ish years ago. They made meticulous observations of the night sky, by eye. They are the first, as far as we know of anyway, to come up with a mathematical model of the sky. Their work also set up modern-day astrology, zodiac signs. If you believe or use them, then you are in a way taking part in a spiritual tradition that dates back almost 3,000 years ago. That, of course, doesn't make them, well, the modern version anyway, any more correct or useful. For instance, I'm a Virgo, so let's do a quick Google search and see what it says about me and podcasting. Well, according to the Times of India, Virgo is going to have a research-heavy podcast with well-structured episodes, fact-checks everything, uses timestamps, which I don't, and has a highly dedicated but small audience that swears by every word. I'm not sure that part's true either. Reader's Digest suggests Virgos are like, will create true crime podcasts. And generally, I detest true crime. There are caveats to this because it, but in reality, when you get down to it, it bothers me because it warps our perception. Statistics and reality often get left behind in true crime. Some kind of magazine or website is another idea. Bustle is the name. Doesn't even have Virgo listed as and directly contradicts the Times of India with respect to one of the other zodiac signs, Aries, as they were rated among the least likely to create a long-running podcast, and in here in Bustle, the most likely. Yeah. The last thing I'll mention with this search and the whole zodiac signs is one result that came up that suggested those with the sign of Aquarius or Virgo are most likely to start a cult. Yeah, it's a mixed bag out there. Nothing empirical or anything. I can't assign a number to it. But, yeah, they're not scientific. Let's just go with that. So, back on track. Away from the zodiac signs. It's important to state that the planets in ancient times, back to 1000 BCE, they were thought of as moving or wandering stars. They weren't thought of as worlds. The Babylonians were making observations of these wandering stars and creating mathematical models around 300 BCE to 400 BCE to predict when they would reappear in the sky. The word planet comes from the Greeks, actually, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, but planetai, loosely meaning wandering light, and not a world or what we have as a modern understanding of what a planet is. So, a very quick rundown on the Greek understanding of the planets. Mercury, the Greeks originally thought it was Apollo when seen at sunrise and Hermes at sunset, two separate objects, but eventually they did get around to recognizing it as one body or light. Venus also thought was two different objects based on morning and evening. Mars, probably because its red color was always just seen as one object instead of two, and Jupiter and Saturn had the same stories as Mars, where they were thought of as a single object. Before 1540, the conventional understanding of the universe had Earth at its center and everything revolved around the Earth. Complex mathematical formulas could predict the positions of the sun, the moon, and the wandering stars, i.e. the planets. The mathematics were developed by Ptolemy, a mathematician born in Alexandria, Egypt, which was a Roman province during his lifetime. See, I almost managed to escape the episode without mentioning the Roman Empire. Well, this mathematical model lasted for nearly 1,500 years. Then came Nicholas Copernicus, the heliocentric model, putting the sun at the center. This new model simplified everything, but it was not accepted everywhere at first. In fact, it wasn't accepted basically anywhere, mostly for religious reasons, and there was no clear observational evidence for the heliocentric model to begin with, and it really delayed its acceptance. But all that began to change with the invention of the telescope in 1608 in the Netherlands. Galileo took that invention, improved on the optics, and turned it towards the night sky. Quickly, observations of the moon's mountains and the valleys and Venus showed a series of phases like the moon, proving Venus orbits the sun. And the discovery of the moons around Jupiter showed that not everything revolved around Earth. Unfortunately for Galileo, the Catholic Church thought this idea was dangerous. I feel even today I'm going into dangerous territory here, which is kind of wild when you think about it. Science is about observations and explaining those observations with continual tests and data. Observational evidence was showing that the Earth was not the center of the universe. The issue was the theological understanding that the universe placed the Earth at its center. The Bible had a number of passages which were interpreted to mean the sun moved around the earth, and the earth was stationary. So a heliocentric model of the universe contradicted faith and therefore represented heresy. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Okay, well, we're not there yet. The Spanish Inquisition doesn't exist. And if you only spent 10 minutes or so searching, that's the story that would be told. However, it's a bit more complicated than that. Copernicus's heliocentric model was originally treated like a mathematical argument or assumption, if you will. It didn't have any evidence behind it. It was a clever solution, as it was conceptually simpler. But the Earth didn't move, because like that would be like totally crazy. Well, with the new observations by Galileo, the scientific world quickly divided itself into three different boxes. There were the philosophers, or the Aristotelians, who were adamant that the heavens were perfect and unchanging. The moon was made of ether, not an earthly matter. It is surprising how often this idea still actually makes its appearances today on the fringes of, like, Flat Earth and other weird Facebook groups that I have been a part of. This group of Aristotelians would go as far as suggesting telescopes had flawed lenses, or that Galileo was misinterpreting the optical illusions. Obfuscate and find ways to throw mud towards what did not align with the worldview. Oh, sounds so familiar. There was the church's choice to explain the data, and seemed to be where the majority of the astronomers at the time were. Tychonics, named after the person who developed the paradigm. They claimed the data could be explained if the sun and the moon orbited Earth, and the other planets orbited the sun. Very important to note, this model at the time could explain the observations. It had the added benefit of being closer to the previous understanding. The Earth didn't move. Scripture interpretation stayed intact. Then there was the Copernicus heliocentric model. Simpler, but if the Earth was moving, parallax should be able to be measured. Well, what is parallax, you ask? Well, let's describe how you can experience it, how, if safe to do so, you can do it right now, and perform this very simple experiment, i.e., if you're driving a car, please don't do it. Hold your thumb out at arm's length. Close one eye and align your thumb with a distant object, like a clock or a picture or a tree if you're outside. Without moving your thumb, close that eye and open the other. Your thumb will appear to have jumped to a new position against that distant background. So if the Earth moved, stars should shift in the sky yearly. Now, no parallax was measured until 1838 using Bessel's measurement of 61 Cygni, which is a star. It was the first successful measurement to show parallax from Earth. I know that this is a science podcast, but typically I try to stay away from overloading with numbers. However, it's kind of here important to understand the parallax problem here and show why early astronomers just couldn't possibly detect it and why the heliocentric model took so long to really be fully adopted. So let's start with the best case scenario, the closest star to Earth, what is Proxima Centauri, which is about 4.24 light years away, or 268,000 astronomical units. If we use the Earth's orbit instead of our two eyes, and astronomical units is just the distance, the average distance of the Earth to the Sun. It's just one of those conventions. Gives us something a little easier to work with instead of like millions and millions and millions of kilometers and miles. So if we use the Earth's orbit instead of our two eyes, i.e. the solstices or the equinoxes, and view the same star, the distance between the baseline is 2 astronomical units. Placing it into the equation works out to approximately 1 astronomical unit over 268,000 astronomical units, or 3.7 times 10 to the negative 6 radians, or 0.76 arcseconds. Okay. Those are numbers, all right. Now let's get back to something we can actually relate those numbers to. This is the equivalent to being able to see the width of a coin 5 kilometers away. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see a person if we just use our eyes at 5 kilometers away. But the width of a coin, that would be impressive. And it comes down to instrumentation and precision. At best, pre-1600 naked eye measurements had errors of 1 to 10 arc minutes, or 60 to 600 times larger than that width of coin that we were just talking about. And early telescopes had instrument accuracy of maybe 10 to 20 arc seconds at best. So while that was still a huge improvement from those naked eye measurements, it was still a bit more than an order of magnitude too imprecise to measure the parallax to the closest star to Earth. So back to the very first time parallax was measured in 1838, 61 Cygni is 10.4 light years away, so quite close. And the measurement was 0.314 arc seconds. This is a theme that comes up again and again in cosmology. Our ability to measure becomes more precise as we open up new avenues of investigation, like Hubble's discovery of galaxies and gravitational lensing. Don't forget, gravitational lensing was covered in season 1 as a two-parter. Freaking awesome. You should go back and listen to it if you have not. To bring this part of the episode to a close, Galileo would continue to make observations and become more convinced that the heliocentric model was correct. Eventually, he made his opinions unequivocal. And he was found guilty of vehement suspicion of heresy and spent the rest of his days under house arrest. Of course, the story doesn't stop there or stop here with Galileo under house arrest. Another astronomer across Europe was figuring out that the planets don't actually move in perfect circles at all. Johannes Kepler, one of science's greatest mystics. An oxymoron, perhaps, but it's an apt one. Overlapping with Galileo, Johannes Kepler published the first 2 laws of planetary motion in 1609, and the third in 1619. Before getting into the laws themselves, why Kepler was able to publish clear arguments dismantling geocentrism and Galileo was walked away? Well, it comes down to a couple of things: location and people. First, I've said it before on this podcast, and I'll say it many, many times, people are weird. It's just the truth. Here I am, on a mic, talking about science to people I have never met. Another common theme in these solo episodes, people are weird, Galileo was argumentative and published a lot of things that were combative, his ideas, and he brought them straight to the masses. So he would just publish for the average person. Kepler was a theologian first, trained as one. I mean, he viewed geometry as divine. If he could describe the world through geometry, in other words, math, then it was proof of God's divine work. It's a very different framing than Galileo. Kepler also published in mathematical arguments, not prose for the average person. So the average theologian would never know what work he published or talked about or wrote about. And he would never know that it essentially argues for the fall of geocentrism, i.e. that the Earth moves. And his work refining heliocentrism. Sometimes it isn't the message, but the messenger. True story. By focusing on the math and the observations, Kepler determined the planets did not move in circles, but ellipses. And so here are his three general planet laws of planetary motion. The first, an orbit of a planet is an ellipse with the sun at one of two foci. Two, a line segment joining a planet and the sun sweeps out equal areas during equal intervals of time. 3. The square of the planet's orbital period is proportional to the cube of the length of its semi-major axis of its orbit. I don't want to get too bogged down here in the details, as I still need to get through Newton before I can get back to the planets themselves. But it's important to mention this. Like, these laws were absolutely fundamental and an important point along our journey here today. Johannes Kepler's attention to detail and academic honesty to not force things to fit ideas that were handed to him led to those three observations that would later be called scientific laws. All the while believing that he was indeed doing God's work by chronicling the divine through geometry. It really takes all types, sometimes even the mystics, to move science forward. So if Kepler described what the planets did, Newton explained why they did it. The guy Sir Isaac Newton was mysterious and a bit of a rebel with respect to the academic thought. His relationship with theology was complicated, much only coming out since 1972, actually, after a bunch of his personal notebooks were made available for public investigation. Here we'll gloss over the academic insults, insecurities, alchemy, the great work he did with the British Mint, and even calculus. Although calculus is there, hidden in the background, for the rest of this episode. It is his seminal work, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, published in 1687, that we cannot ignore. It was here that Newton unified physics, brought about classical mechanics, and explained gravity. It provided the why to the orbits of the planets. We now had the ability to predict the movement of all planets and many other phenomena. Okay, up to this point, the world was still only aware of the six inner planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. We had the how and the why. We also had telescopes, which needed better manufacturing and better understanding of the optics to make them more powerful. The next planet in the solar system was waiting to be observed. Funny thing is that the next planet had previously been observed before. What is known today as Uranus had been seen and documented many, many times before. The earliest possible is way, way back in 128 BCE by Greek astronomer, geographer, and mathematician Hipparchus. Uranus technically can be seen without a telescope, but it requires really dark skies, which is definitely a problem today. The other issue with potentially identifying it as a planet by the eye is that it moves so slowly. It makes a full orbit every 84 Earth years. So it would take very careful observations over many, many years to identify it as a planet or wandering heavenly light. Dim, and it didn't wander very much. In 1781, British amateur telescope builder, astronomer, composer, titles, so many titles, noticed something in the sky He looked like a disc and not a star. William Herschel. The long and the short of it is that William Herschel thought he had found a comet. It took data from others to convince him otherwise. It was the first recognized planet since antiquity. Well, detailed observations of Uranus continued to be made across the world, and in 1821, 40 years later, astronomical tables for the orbit of Uranus were published. It provided predictions based on Newton's equations of gravity. There were inconsistencies between the calculations and the observations. This really became evident as Uranus nearly completed a full orbit from the start of observations in 1847. There were three general hypotheses to explain these discrepancies. The influence of the sun's gravity may be different than Newton's description at a distance, the result of observational error, or three, another celestial body out there is gravitationally tugging on Uranus. Now, whenever there's a defined problem, there's a race to be the first to figure it out. Harkening back a few episodes to the geophysical inversions, this is an ill-posed problem. It wasn't a race like that of Oppenheimer trying to get an atomic bomb, or anything like that. It was only prestige on the line. And it ended up in controversy. Again, we come back to this idea that people are people, and they do weird things. In fact, some have called it a heist. Here's a question. Why are the pyramids still in Egypt? Well, because the British couldn't fit them into a museum. That joke will make sense in a few more moments. Shout out to the show or the podcast, Stuff the British Stole. Sometimes those episodes are truly amazing, like the one on the Parthenon. Okay, back on track. The person credited with the mathematically predicting the orbit of Neptune first via mathematical predictions is Urbain Le Verrier, a French astronomer and mathematician. Sorry, terrible ability to do the accent and pronounce it. Well, anyway, Monsieur Verrier publicly announced his calculations to the French Academy on the 31st of August in 1846, and then sent the predictions to Johann Galle, a German astronomer at the Berlin Observatory. Once it arrived, Johann promptly took that information and used it. That night, on September 23rd, 1846, Neptune was officially discovered. So why the joke about Britain at the top? Well, there are usually multiple people looking at similar things at similar times. There's also, at least at this point in time, a lot of bragging rights on the line. Nationalism. This should not be a surprise. I mean, look at the Cold War and the race to the moon. So a British mathematician and astronomer, John Couch Adams. This is where sources begin to contradict somewhat, and the deeper you go, the little bit more confused you get, and you have to try to eventually take a side. And that often happens where there's controversy. People being people. Especially when there's so much prestige on the line. Today it is, of course, just a quirk of history, but it's still interesting to explore these just for a moment. Picture a young man. One who liked to calculate things to many decimal places. Like that engineering friend that knows pi to 17 decimal places. Not terribly interested in actually writing up his results and doing papers, but loves to solve those complex mathematical problems. As part of that, his calculations for Neptune were ping-ponging around, or as the source I used, you like the word vacillating, on his solution. He couldn't just, you know, give one number. It wasn't fixed. He was tinkering. It didn't come out with a whole lot of confidence, and was, you know, somewhat ignored by British academics because of it. When Le Verrier's predictions and discovery came out, there was a scramble to save and take some credit for Britain. Curiously, correspondence of Neptune and its discovery was lost in Britain. In 1999, it was found in an observation in Chile. Sometimes the truth is just too hard to make up. Well, it seems, based on those documents anyway, the British case for getting credit was built largely after the discovery was made. It was absolutely true that John Couch Adams did similar calculation and came up with a similar answer. The timing and strength of the conviction was not 100%. So you could argue that the British, on a national level anyway, stole the discovery. John Couch Adams did, and probably rightly so, deserves credit for solving the same problem. But as a host here on this podcast, my bias is with Laverner taking the gold medal, if there was such a thing. Okay, one more deviation on this. The American scientific establishment tried to take part in the prestige game too. Game of Thrones, Astronomy Science Edition. The nerdiest show ever conceived. Well, after the discovery was known in the United States, a race was on to claim some of the credit. And yes, the Americans tried to jump in too. Once the word the Neptune's discovery crossed the Atlantic, the U.S. scientific establishment moved fast to carve out a slice of the glory. Several American astronomers claimed that they had independently performed calculations that pointed to an unseen planet. And a few scientific societies rushed to publish statements asserting that the first full orbital solution was produced on their side of the ocean. It was mainly a patriotism and opportunism mixed together kind of thing. Less careful mathematics and more. We're also working on that. A bit of scientific FOMO before the phrase existed. In the end, the Americans' claims didn't materially change the priority dispute, but they do add a delightful extra wrinkle into the international scramble for prestige. Okay, so we had Neptune. The next planet to be discovered, quote-unquote, Pluto. In the early 20th century, Percival Lowell, founder of the Lowell Observatory in Arizona, became obsessed with the idea of the ninth planet, which he called Planet X. Now here's the part that often gets glossed over. The entire premise of Planet X rested on bad numbers. The irregularities Lowell saw in the Uranus and Neptune's motions weren't the gravitational footprints of a hidden giant world out there in the solar system just needing to be found. They were mostly bookkeeping errors. For one, the massive Neptune in Lowell's era was slightly overestimated. That meant the predicted tug on Neptune should exert on Uranus didn't match what astronomers actually observed. The mismatch looked mysterious, even persuasive, if you didn't know that the mass was wrong. But Neptune's true mass wouldn't be nailed down until Voyager 2 flew past in 1989, long after Lowell's time, revealing that the earlier value had been off enough to throw off the calculations. Add to that the small observational errors baked into 19th century measurements, telescope pointing uncertainties, timing inaccuracies, star catalog offsets. Remember, astronomers were taking positions by hand, comparing them to imperfect star charts, squeezing out meaning of numbers that carried more noise than they realized. When you stack a few tenths of an arc second of measurement error year after year and then plug those into a perturbation equations, you can magically discover forces that just aren't there. Lowell couldn't have known that many of the so-called orbital anomalies were just artifacts in the data. But Lowell believed those irregularities hinted at another massive body further out. He spent the final decade of his life searching for it. He died without success, but his observatory kept the hunt alive. Enter Clyde Tombaugh, a young Kansas farm kid with a knack of building telescopes. Hired by Lowell Observatory in 1929, his job was simple in description and brutal in execution. Photograph the sky, then photograph it again, and compare the plates under a blink comparator. Basically, you line up the plates of the photos and compare them to something that's blinking, and you're looking for anything through thousands of stars, night after night, many, many, many photos, staring into bright lights, looking for anything, anything at all that moved. Then on February 18th, 1930, Tombaugh spotted it, a tiny wandering dot against the star field. After the Lowell Observatory confirmed the motion and the announced the discovery, the world embraced Pluto. Headlines everywhere, school textbooks were updated practically overnight. A schoolgirl in Oxford even provided the name Pluto, continuing the tradition of mythological underworld gods for the outer planets. And conveniently, it started with a P and then an L, Lowell's initials. But before I move on, a quick deviation. The idea of a ninth planet never really died. Well, Planet X left kind of a gravitational ghost in the scientific imagination, if you will. Once Pluto was found, it didn't exactly solve the orbital oddities Lowell thought it would. Pluto was way too small. So the hypothesis lingered in the background, and over the decades, every time an astronomer saw something a little strange in the outer solar system, the old dream of a hidden massive world got revived. And then, of course, the conspiracy world grabbed a hold of it too. Nibiru, I think I'm pronouncing it right, or Planet X, the supposed doomsday planet that was always conveniently just about to swing into the inner solar system any moment now. People wrote books, made documentaries, and predicted the end of the world more times than I can count, and way more times than I have episodes. None of it based in observation. All of it nonsense. But it shows just how persistent the idea of missing giant planet can be. Once it's in the culture, it sticks. Scientifically, though, the question is still interesting, but for very different reasons. In the last decade, several teams have noticed unusual clustering in the orbits of distant Kuiper Belt objects. So these are objects that are way out there, beyond kind of Pluto's kind of right on the edge of these objects. And some astronomers argue that the alignment of those orbits might be explained by a large unseen body further out. Maybe in the Oort cloud, which is a region even beyond the Kuiper Belt, or approaching it. Something several times the mass of the Earth on a long stretched out orbit. It's not proven. There are competing explanations, including observational biases, but the fact remains that the Planet 9 idea is very much alive in serious academic scientific circles today, just not as doom or mythology, but as a legitimate open question in orbital dynamics. Of course, Pluto's status didn't survive the 21st century. The better our telescopes got, the more icy worlds were found in the Kuiper Belt, many of them similar in size to Pluto, some of them like Eris, even slightly larger. At that point, astronomers had to choose. Either suddenly we had dozens of planets, or we refine the definition. In 2006, the International Astronomical Union drew the line, and Pluto fell on the dwarf planet side. No, not because it wasn't interesting, not because it wasn't beloved, but because it hadn't fully cleared out its orbit or neighborhood of other debris. The rules changed, and Pluto, poor Pluto, lost its gold medal status. And that's where I'm ending this episode. From the nationalistic chaos of Neptune's discovery to the quite careful plate blinking that earned Pluto its brief time among the planets, and finally, its demotion. A reminder that science isn't just equations. It's also people, pride, timing, and sometimes the willingness to say, we were wrong. Let's classify this properly. So once again, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, happy solstice, and all the others that are out there. I'm so looking forward to the new year right here on Whimsical Wavelengths, and I really hope that you're going to join me. Yes, today's episode wasn't the Star of Bethlehem, but we were looking at the wandering stars, the planets. Still kind of Christmas-themed. I wasn't going to try too hard, don't worry. So if you haven't already done so, subscribe. Tell a friend. It's really important. So I'll catch you guys in the new year with the new episode with my past PhD supervisor, Dr. Glenn Williams-Jones. Remember, gonna do that encore edition for the next episode in 2 weeks. I'll see you then.
In a world so chaotic, so misbehaved, echoes of melodies remind us it's always colors weave stories painting the sky, swaying to rhythms as the galaxies fly by.